Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizohan Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
Nice to see everybody. It's amazing how one small prayer sums up the whole practice. And yet, if you can't see it, you don't see it, you know. I think that's the way that our whole life works. Until we're able to recognize and realize certain things, we remain either blind to them or on purpose blind to them, as we say, ignorance. This ignorant state. I wrote a little poem. I've actually read this one here before, but it kind of, I like it, and it fits somewhat, if any of it really fits. I titled this talk Sutras and the Floorboards, and I guess there's a reason for that, but maybe we'll get to that. So I'll read the poem first. Have you ever heard the hallway breathing? The secrets of the floor whispering in gentle numbness. The dusty corners cradling the silent strings of spiders. How else does one communicate? I, they, we return the rhetorical question with a warm palm to the cold floor. What was my favorite color? When was my favorite color? Why are these limbs blue and distant? Is this reflection of me red? Whose light shines from under the last door? All these questions, all these inquiries, all this noise in a wooden brain. Let me just sit down, without thought, without want. Simple reflections of red and black, and an ethereal shape peering out towards a voice that bellows from the unseen. In gentle gratitude, one can't help but bow in reverence. So a lot of my poems that I write are based off of my, of course, the way I see things, but also experiences that I've had. And I try to put them in some kind of understandable kind of way, because I like the inquiry. I like the question behind things, you know, because it offers us a way to become curious, to become reflective, you know, in this contemplative life. If we don't, I just hold on to things as I think I already know them, you know. The nature of mind and Buddha are not two things, not separate. This is why the sixth patriarch, Huang Neng, when asked by a student, "What is Buddha nature?" he replied, "Your everyday mind." What is Buddha nature? Is your everyday mind. But this is not a complete answer, just like all definitions and descriptions. They lack something. They lack a lot of something, you know. From a scientific standpoint, ego could be nothing more than a chemical response to the outer stimulus of our life. Could you imagine? The ego is just a little chemical response in the mind. Look, 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 look. All the time. You ever feel like that? Could you imagine we make all of this seemingly nightmarish experiences in our life, and they're all coming from a little beep, 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 beep? Well, as science goes deeper and deeper and is able to study the mind more and more, this is all they find. It's a section of the mind that is so drawn to survival that all it looks for is safety and danger, safety and danger, safety and danger. 24/7, never turns off. So this is what science is getting closer and closer to recognizing, is where this is coming from, what is feeding it, and the true spiritual practices still keep coming back to this age-old thing of stop chasing, stop running, stop looking. It's right here. The Tibetan nuns have a beautiful prayer. It says, "Don't wander, don't wander. Place mindfulness on guard. Along the road of distractions, Mara lies in ambush. Mara is the mind clinging to like and dislike. So look to the essence of this magic and realize. So look to the essence of this magic, free from dualistic fixation, and realize your mind is unaltered primordial purity, unfabricated primordial purity. There is no Buddha elsewhere. Look at your own face. There is nothing left to search for. Rest in your own place." So all of these ancient practices that thankfully are still that are still handed down through generations, they come back to the same solution every time. When you stop chasing it, when you stop searching for it, it reveals itself, you know? It reveals itself in very simple ways. So from a scientific standpoint, ego could be nothing more than a chemical response to the outer stimulus of our life. And these responses have no break unless you are unconscious or sleeping, which means they never turn off. That's the nature of it. It's the nature of mind. In Buddhism, we say we must understand the nature of the mind. And so science is doing this, but we can also do this on our own, because if we really look out when Siddhartha was alive, or all these saints and sages since, they didn't have these scientific tools, they didn't have these measurements, you know, and they saw the same exact thing. Basically, the ego's role is to create a landscape that appears to be understood and somewhat manageable. It appears to be understood and somewhat manageable. And this is because the mind has to make all of these things kind of very small to put into this little container. We have to shrink everything down. We have to simplify it so that we're able to feel somewhat relaxed in this kind of chaotic soup that we live in, you know? The universe is so huge, but it's not out there. It's right here, you know? It's right within all of us. We all carry the entire cosmos within us. That's why when we open the Dharma, we say it's incomparable. It's profound and minutely subtle. The universe that we see on the stars is no different than the universe that's between our ears, you know? They say there's, I forget how many stars they believe that's in the known galaxy. It's like, I don't know, it's got like 7 or 10 zeros behind it. And they say there's the same exact number, if not more, of neuron connectors in the mind. So you have the same amount of stars in the mind, firing constantly, you know, firing everywhere. Little suns all squished in there. So the ego's role is to create this landscape that appears to be understood and somewhat manageable. And there's a really good reason for this. Because as we're born out of the soup and into the world, you know, we need some kind of beginning standpoint. Could you try and imagine explaining algebra to a 2-year-old? You know, could you imagine explaining like the way a motor works to a 1-year-old? Like, it just doesn't work. So we need to slowly build this function of recognizing and realizing life to its totality. But I think all of us get stuck. We all get stuck in the immature state. You know, we all get stuck in this in this adolescent state. This is what it feels like anyway. Because I meet so many people, so many grown adults that still have very childlike reactions in life, you know? So it makes perfect sense. We get stuck in the adolescent, and there's good reason for it. We never really get taught how to look at it correctly, how to look at it and hold all of it. It's a lot to hold, you know? So in some ways, it's easy to see why we're so stressed and vulnerable, or any number of reactions that happen within each one of us. Everybody has their own little spin to it, you know. When we step out into new experiences, when we move away from the known, this is when we go into turmoil, you know. Because the known is comfortable. Even when the known is terrible, this is why people stay in terrible situations. Because the known is comfortable. I know it. Even though it's bad, I know the bad. And a lot of people, and I'm sure a lot of people can recognize this, it's easy to get comfortable in something that doesn't feel good. We just get comfortable to it. So when we experience new experiences, or when we're pushed into new experiences in life, this is why we kind of go a bit crazy, you know? This is why mindfulness or awareness is the medicine that awakens Buddha nature. For one must go beyond the senses, beyond the chemical reactions, and just sit, to go beyond them. Not that you can escape them, but we learn to face them. We learn to become one with it, you know? It's like becoming one with the body and mind as we sit in Zazen. If I sit here waiting for something, I miss it every time. If I sit here complaining inside the whole time, I miss it every time. And so it's this merging of this body-mind. In Tibet, there's the story of a monkey that lives in a small building, a little concrete box, and has six windows. And because the monkey has nothing else to do, the monkey just jumps from window to window to window to window to window all day long, running here and running here. And the windows are the analogy of the senses, the eyes and ears and taste and touch, smell and thoughts. And so the monkey just all day long runs from one, hungry for the next, hungry for this one, hungry for that one. And never realizing that he's stuck in this little concrete box, you know. And so the Tibetans say we need to learn how to close these windows when we're practicing. Because even while we're sitting in Zazen, even while we're sitting in meditation, the windows are wide open, you know. I'm so drawn, like Donan's over here sniffling and I'm going, that's my window, I gotta shut it. Big deal, it's just sniffle, you know. That's not what I was really doing. I was imagining some boogers running down your face. But we have this ability to close these windows. And to do that is kind of a weird magic, because I can't reach over and go bloop. I can't shut that window. It's an internal window that I'm creating. So how do I recognize the creator, you know? How do I recognize this? I must learn to get quiet enough to see how the creator operates. What's the voice of the creator? What's the voice of the complainer, if you will? What's the voice of the griper, you know? And little by little, as I see this, and I realize that there is no real danger. This is what's amazing again, if we come back to the way the mind is designed. I confuse comfort for danger. When I'm not comfortable, I confuse it for being in danger. Our teacher Roshi would talk about this all the time, is that in thousands of years ago, maybe in caveman time, the ego was completely necessary because we had everything chasing us down trying to eat us. But as we somewhat evolved and this ego nature was no longer really necessary, we started to morph it from protection of the self to protection of what I think I am. So we're just trying to protect our emotions. I'm trying to protect the way I feel, you know? Which is just kind of, it's fruitless, you know? So these windows are, although they're symbolic, they do exist within us. And we do have this ability to recognize the window as we race to one and we race to another. And I go, I just come back. And this is why I named this teaching Sutra in the Floorboards. Because for me, if I sit here with my eyes closed the whole time, it's so easy for me to daydream. I'm still just jumping from window to window. So the way that I come back is I open my eyes and I look right at my floor. Oh yes, I'm just sitting. Oh yes, I'm just in this strange soup, you know? So this is my sutra in the Floorboards. The floor actually becomes the return. It's my anchor back, you know, back to reality, instead of being lost again in all the senses, lost in the windows. So for those who wish to see beyond seeing, hear beyond hearing, taste beyond tasting, we must learn how to set all these senses aside, to close all the windows. This is Zazen. This is isolation with others. It's an interesting little way to see it. Isolation with others. You know, it's like the old saying, I can't do this alone, but I must do it by myself. You know? We must all go through the process ourselves. You know? The words are neat, but that's where they stop. You know? The definitions are neat, but that's where they stop, you know. And if we're not careful with them, I'll just make a whole new game out of words and definitions, you know. I wanted to share this from Master Dogen. This is from the Genjo Koan, the Shobogenzo. And if you can listen to his words in a poetic way without trying to understand it, then there's a real beauty to it. If you're trying to understand it and grasp it, it just leaves us confused, you know? Know that the entire heaven and earth are the roots, stem, branches, and leaves of the tall bamboo. This makes heaven and earth timeless. This makes the great oceans, Mount Samaru, and the worlds of the ten directions indestructible. A walking stick and an arched bamboo stick are old and beyond old. A plantain has earth, water, fire, air, and emptiness, as well as mind, consciousness, and wisdom as its roots, stems, branches, leaves, and flowers. The fruits, colors, and forms. Accordingly, the plantain wears the autumn wind and is torn in the autumn wind. We know that it is pure and clear, and that not a single particle is excluded. There is no muscle in the eye, there is no pigment in the paints. This is emancipation right here, as emancipation is not a matter of time. It is not concerned with a discussion of a certain moment or instant. Taking up this understanding, make earth, water, fire, and air your vital activity. Make mind consciousness and wisdom your great death. In this manner, the activities of the Buddha house have been passed on with spring, autumn, winter, and summer, as all the furnishings, all the essentials. So for me, this practice is really, it really asks me time and time again just to show up to the strangeness of all of it, to the unknown of all of it, you know? Because the more that I grasp onto what I think is right or what I think is wrong, the more I suffer. And the more others around me suffer for it, because I blame them as well. I've had so many things in the last couple months of my life, all these kind of crazy upheavals. My father passing, and now I have some conflict in my family because of the will that my father, oh my God, all this stuff. Things with my partner, and I just keep showing up like this. I don't know. I don't know the answers to all of it. And from that place, my real point to showing up that way is I don't wish to cause harm because I don't understand or because I think people are doing things the wrong way. And so I just take this backward step, as Dogen puts it. Take this backward step and just observe what's happening, you know? And at times I put in my two cents, and most of the time I step out of it, you know? But it does take practice to get to a place like that, so that I can live in the turmoil without being the turmoil. I love that, you know. I can live in turmoil without being the turmoil, even though I still feel it. You know, it's still there. That's what's amazing about the energies that rise through us. You know, and just like Dogen's writing here. Taking up this understanding, make earth, water, fire, and air your vital activity. So instead of these being negatives within me, the turmoil, or the energies that are arising, how can I embrace them as a natural aspect of this living quality? How can I turn that? Because the old mind wants to go, this is terrible. And the new me goes, you know, what's happening here? I remember listening to Ram Dass, and he was talking about the dying process, and the Tibetans use these four elements, the earth elements, as a way to describe the dying process. And they say that as the person starts to go into this death process, they start to get cold. So the fire element starts to go away, or the fire element starts to return to the earth. They start to get really thirsty, so the water element starts to return to the earth. You know? The earth element starts to return, and they get like really heavy. They can't move very easily. So it was really amazing when we're able to see all of these things from a different perspective, and that they show us that we are the living embodiment of all these energies. We are the living embodiment of life itself. But this ego nature confuses it, or is scared of it. So it tries to put it in a little manageable box. The box is too small. The box is too small. And I just had this little writing from Alan Watts, because I think he sums up the point of this, is learning to really become present means that I must really learn how to concentrate. I must learn how to shift my concentration. My concentration is so deeply rooted in me, myself, and I. All of my worries and my problems and all this stuff, that when we start to talk about, or we start to direct people into a new way of concentration, it's so difficult for us, you know? So he says it really beautiful here. You cannot, at the same time, concentrate and think about concentrating. It sounds almost silly to say, but the only way to concentrate is to concentrate. In actually doing it, the idea of doing it disappears. And this is the same thing as saying that religion disappears when it becomes real and effective. Now, a great deal of the talk about the difficulty of action or the difficulty of concentration is sheer nonsense. If we are sitting down together at a meal and I say to you, please pass the salt, you just do it, and there is no difficulty about it. You do not stop to consider the right method. You do not trouble yourself with the problem of how, when you have picked up the salt shaker, you are going to be able to concentrate on it long enough to bring it to my end of the table. Now, there is absolutely no difference between this and concentrating the mind's attention to see into the nature of reality. If you can concentrate the mind for 2 seconds, you can do it for 2 minutes. And if you can do it for 2 minutes, you can do it for 2 hours. Of course, if you want to make this kind of thing horribly difficult, you begin to think about timing yourself. Instead of concentrating, you begin to think about whether you are concentrating, and about how long you have concentrated, and about how much longer you're going to keep it up. All of this is totally off the point. Concentrate for 1 second. If at the end of this your mind has wandered off, concentrate for another second, and then another. Nobody ever has to concentrate for more than 1 second. This one. It says it in such a beautiful way, you know. And so the Sutra of the Floorboards is my ability to come back so quickly if I practice, if I remember. To come back quickly, because the minute I close these eyes, all the windows go wide open and I start searching around in the ether, you know. Osho said that at the time of the Buddha's death, he said one word to his monks and nuns. He said samasati, and samasati means to remember. And what he was saying was to remember these teachings quickly. Think about how quick our ego operates. Boom! So he said awareness must be just as fast. Our remembering must be just as fast so that I can see it. Oh, there it is. Hello, anger. Hello, fear. Hello, this and all this, you know. There it is. It arises. So the more that we practice with it, the more that we learn to concentrate one moment at a time, the more that we strengthen this ability. It is a muscle within us, you know. And so, whatever it takes, if you wish to memorize sutras, that's a beautiful practice. If you wish to just come back to the floor time and time again, this is a beautiful. If you wish to come back to the breath time and time again, if that returns you to this moment, you know. Even the pain in the body is a great reminder of coming back to the moment. I think it's a hindrance, but it's a great reminder. Whew. Because I don't know about you, when the pain gets really kind of severe in my body, I love to go off into the back rooms, you know, because I forget about the pain and I focus on the little stories that are going on. So when I come back to the body, I go, oh, there it is, you know, all of it. And then I come back to the breath and the floor. All the furnishings.